Hello, this is Terrence McNally. This weekend, as we celebrate Mother's Day, you'll hear my 2013 conversation with Hazel Henderson, who, as a mom in the 1970s who'd never been to college, got upset about pollution threatening her young child, became an activist, and developed into a global expert on economics and sustainability.
As we approach the end of another year, let's step back and look at where we are in the big picture. What do you think are the most critical issues facing the U.S. and the world? And how do you see things moving in those areas? How are things getting worse or better? And what should we be keeping our eyes on in the year to come? I'm going to have this conversation in the studio today with Hazel Henderson. Well, she'll be on by phone, but that's what we're going to talk about. And she's a woman who's been asking those sorts of questions for at least the last 40 years. Now, we're going to approach this exploration globally as well as nationally, with a long-term view, and with an eye toward relationships and systems that we often miss, I think, in our day-to-day focus on the latest news and events. And I hope that we can shed some light on the most promising possibilities for solving problems, as well as on what's happening under the radar, for good or ill, that deserves more of our attention and that we're not noticing. Here on Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, and the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, and provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, culture, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Hazel Henderson is the founder of Ethical Markets Media, and the creator and co-executive producer of its TV series. She's a futurist, an evolutionary economist, a globally syndicated columnist, and a consultant on sustainable development. The first version of her Country Futures Indicators, an alternative to the gross domestic product, is a co-venture with Calvert Group, the Calvert Henderson Quality of Life Indicators. And Henderson is the author of 10 books, including Building a Win-Win World, Life Beyond Global Economic Warfare, Ethical Markets, Growing the Green Economy, and her upcoming Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. Welcome again to Free Forum, Hazel Henderson.
Thank you, Terrence. It's great to be with you again.
Okay. And I want to approach this a little differently today, Hazel, as I sort of inferred. I usually focus, at least to some extent, on a guest's current work or book, film, campaign. But today, I'd rather ask, as I said, some big picture, big context, life perspective kind of questions. And I'm fine with you throwing in all the specific and practical evidence and examples you want, but I'm going to come at it from a fairly wide angle, okay?
Good.
And I like listeners to get a... Yeah, exactly. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about. So can you tell us, in your own words, a bit about your path to the work that you do today? Feel free to mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, because I know your path is a bit unorthodox, especially the early steps. At one point, weren't you just a mom upset about something?
Oh, exactly. That's where I began. And in New York City, where I was indeed a mom, raising my daughter right under the Consolidated Edison smokestacks next to the UN building. And all of us moms in the play park were, you know, terribly worried about, because all of the soot was falling so clear, you know. So I ended up, you know, organizing a group of moms in an NGO that we called Citizens for Clean Air. And it seemed so logical to me, you know, that in spite of all of the economists that I ran into who would say, well, it isn't really a problem, you know, and how do you know it's a problem? If you just come at it as a parent, and of course I had come from Britain and remembered the big smog there in London in 1952, where about 4,000 people died in a week. So I did know that air pollution was really serious stuff. And yet what I found was that that became the most incredible learning experience for me, because I was being thrown onto radio shows and, you know, all of that to debate economists and to debate business leaders. And back then, Even the mayor of New York told me that it was just mist rolling in from the sea. So what our little organization did was we contacted our newly elected senator back then, who was the late Senator Robert Kennedy, and we took him on a helicopter ride around New York City and showed him all of the sources of air pollution, not only from all the power plants and the factories, but from all of the little brownstone apartment buildings. Everybody was allowed to kind of, you couldn't say burn, cook their garbage, you know, and there was all of this mess.
People and were actually doing that? In New York City?
Back then it was okay to do that. But, of course, you know, they were burning at very, very low temperatures. And so Senator Kennedy, you know, we told him that what we had decided, of course, based mostly on me cracking the books, which I've always loved to do, that the gross national product needed to be changed because it counted the pollution as useful additional product. And it also counted the cleaning up of the pollution and the hospital bills also as useful additions to the GDP and the gross national product. And so that was one of the first things that we said that should be changed, because we said, surely you have to separate the goods from the bads, the wealth from the ills, and you have to subtract the bads and come up with a net figure. And so dear Senator Kennedy totally bought it, and he went off and made that speech at the University of California.
Yeah, I was just going to say, Hazel, I've often referred to that speech and quoted that speech. I don't have it with me right now, but I didn't realize the germination.
We loved it. And so, of course, we had a champion right off the bat. And I still have framed in my library the thank you letter from him to me personally, thanking us for showing him all of this pollution.
I cut you off. That speech that Robert Kennedy made was one of the first places that I've seen someone certainly of his stature, someone right in the mainstream, pointing out that the GDP or the GNP, whichever you call it, is just the sum total of goods and bads. And as you point out, pollution adds to GDP. A divorce is great for GDP. A hurricane, you know, all of these things actually boost GDP.
And so one of the first things we did, you know, I joined up with Ralph Nader because I got very excited about the campaign he was doing in 1968. This is the 60s, the campaign to make General Motors responsible. And by that time, we knew that a third of all of the New York City's air pollution came from Detroit, from all of these gas-guzzling automobiles. And so I joined up with Nader, and of course, have remained friends with him ever since. And, one of the things that I did was to get the insurance industry on our side, making the point to many of them, you know, that, look, you're paying out all these claims for emphysema and all of this, and why wouldn't you join our campaign, you know, to put three additional people on the board of General Motors? And I got some of the big insurance executives in New York to become backers of Citizens for Clean Air. So I was just romping around as a newly naturalized U.S. citizen and feeling, you know, my oats, because, you see, in Britain, the kind of thing that would happen back then would be, oh, well, they'd appoint a Queen's Commission or something to look into air pollution. But here I was, a newly minted U.S. citizen, and I suddenly realized, oh, isn't this thrilling, that my vote is leveraged by all the other people who don't bother to vote. And so, you know, I was just totally energized, apart from the fact that we knew we needed to do something for our kids' future. So that's certainly how I began. And what happened was that it got me on this huge learning jag. And you couldn't possibly learn about any of this stuff by going and taking a course in economics. I'd never gone to college. And I thought, well, my gosh, I better go to college. And so I was writing to, like, Columbia University and all of these NYU and saying, please, do you have a course that I could take which relates economics to political science, to ecology, to biology, to social science, to psychology? And of course they all came back and said, no, nothing like that.
You know? Well, I mean, beyond the fact even of the specifics of what you were trying to mesh there, at least then, I think it's changed a bit and continues to change, but
the very notion
of mixing disparate fields was anathema to academia.
Oh, yes, they were all in those silos, you know. And of course, I was just coming at it from a whole systems point of view, because that's what you do when you're an activist. And so I remember sitting down in about 67, and kind of exhausted and burned out from all of this activity. You know, we had block captains in all of the boroughs of New York City, and we had 40,000 members, and I was just, you know, getting really burned out. And so I sat down and I wrote a great long article about what I thought corporate responsibility was for pollution and for, you know, cleaning up the social problems they create. And I sent it to the only woman on the masthead of the Harvard Business Review, who happened to, you know, I thought, well, maybe she'll listen to me. And I wrote a sort of quite belligerent letter saying, look, I am not an academic. I am a citizen activist. And, you know, I'm head of this organization, Citizens for Clean Air. And this is what I think. And to my total amazement, Terry, about 3 weeks later, I got a telephone call from the Harvard Business Review saying, we're going to publish your article.
You know what's interesting to me, Hazel, I just want to cut in for a second, is that particular moment when something that in essence shouldn't have happened, if you know what
right.
I mean, that given the way the clubs work and you know, and the way, you know, peer pressure and all of those things, but the fact that somebody said, let's go outside the box here, let's publish this, because I think you would have been an activist anyway. But the turning point that made was it also gave you credibility, not just as an activist, but as a thinker, you know, all of that. I think it's quite fascinating. Before you go on, let me tell people, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Hazel Henderson. She's an economist, a teacher, a writer, creator of the television show and website Ethical Markets. Her next book, come out in a couple of months, I believe. You can correct me if I'm wrong. Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. And you can learn more at Ethical Markets, one word, ethicalmarkets.com, or Hazel Henderson, also one word, hazelhenderson.com. So go ahead.
Yes, yes. So what happened? This article got published in 1967, and, you know, they tamed down the title. They called it something like, Should Business Tackle Society's Problems? And I thought, oh, how silly. Of course they should, you know, particularly the ones they've created, right? But anyway, what happened, I didn't realize this, but when you get an article published in the Harvard Business Review, at least that was so in the 1960s, everybody assumes you have a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
And so they send out, you know, hundreds of copies of these all over the place. And so my phone started ringing, and business schools all over the world were inviting me to lecture on business ethics. And I was terrified. I thought, my God, you know, I mean, I feel like I'm, you know, flying at 60,000 feet, you know, without a parachute.
I mean, yeah, well, I mean, part of it also is that not only are you not an academic, but you weren't in business either.
No, absolutely. I was a critic. In fact, it was really funny. After that article was published, and then I did another one in the Financial Analyst Journal saying that they had to shift their financial models towards sustainability and quality of life. And when that came out, it was a sort of a similar thing. So anyway, I would ask these business schools, and, you know, I'm talking Stanford, MIT, Tuck, all of them. And I began by asking them, well, don't you have a professor who teaches ethics? And they said, well, no. And so I said, well, is it an elective? No. Then I thought, okay, what the hell? I'm going. You know,
yeah.
I'm just going to let my little light shine. I'm going to tell them my experience. I'll stand on what I know and, you know, what I have come up against, you know, with Consolidated Edison and General Motors and being part of the Nader campaign and so on and so forth. And so for me, it was just an enormous sort of learning jag. And then I got, I gave a speech before the National Association of Business Economists that was published in the front page of the business section of the New York Times. And I was, I mean, honestly, Terrence, I just thought, oh, you know, this is just extraordinary. You know, what is happening? What
yeah.
am I supposed to do?
Yeah. And as you keep, you've mentioned a few times, but just so anyone who tunes in late, we're talking about the late 60s. This is not
yes.
the middle of the 80s or 90s. This is the late 60s. This is excellent. Go ahead.
So anyway, the next thing that happened is the faculty at Columbia University contacted me and said, we would like to invite you to join our faculty committee on technology and social change. And I said, oh, how nice. Thank you very much. And so then I'm on this faculty committee at Columbia University, and I never went to college. And that's where I met the wonderful Barbara Ward, who wrote Spaceship Earth in 1962 and helped organize the first Earth Summit, which was held in Stockholm, if you may remember. Maybe you weren't born then.
No, I was. I actually graduated college in 69.
Oh, okay. Right. So I ended up in Stockholm covering the first Earth Summit and met all of these wonderful people. And then I found out that really the problem was that all of these new technologies were getting out of the box, nuclear power and supersonic transport and GMO foods and all that. And they were getting out of the box without any kind of an assessment of their social or environmental impacts. And I thought, well, okay, I'll contact this congressman who introduced this bill to set up a U.S. Office of Technology Assessment. And he was a congressman from Connecticut called Emilio Daddario. So I wrote to him and said, I want to, and our citizens group, you know, Citizens for Clean Air, I want to support your bill, and how can we help, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, the bill got through in 1974, and it had set up an advisory council. And one spot on this 12-person advisory council was for public education. So I jumped in and wrote to my senator. I was living in New Jersey by that time. And I said, can you support me to be appointed to this public seat? Because he was one of the senators who had helped pass this bill. And I said, I will send out letters to all my friends in the public interest movement and the Nader movement and make sure that you have lots of letters supporting my candidacy so that, you know, I can be sort of the public voice on this thing. So I sent out my 200 letters. This was in the old steam mail.
Yeah,
you know,
oh yeah.
There was no email. And licking the stamps and all that. And I sort of waited to see what would happen. And about a month later, I got a call from Senator Clifford Case's office, who was the senator from New Jersey. And his AA said, you know, are you Hazel Henderson? He said, the senator wants to meet you. because you said we've had so many letters supporting your candidacy that we feel you're the only person on that whole advisory council who's kind of, you know, non-negotiable. We're going to have to appoint you. So I went down there, and I duly got appointed. And so then here I was in 1974 with no college degree, and I'm on this Technology Assessment Advisory Council to the U.S. Congress, and I'm the only non-Nobel Prize winner, the only non-president of a high-tech company, and I'm serving with the Secretary of Defense and the head of the General Accounting Office and the president of Dow Chemical and the president of Texas Instruments and all the rest of them were Nobel Prize winners. So, you know, I thought, you know, because you can imagine how I fell in love with my new mother country.
Oh, my God. I mean, what's interesting about your story, and I knew it, but it's refreshing to hear it again, is that it's more unorthodox than I remembered. That you by dint of timing and some of it just happenstance, you know, who happened to be your senator, your representative, and then by your own talent and will, I mean, the idea of going from becoming a citizen to being on a federal panel of assessing technology within this country in a period of a few years.
Yes, it was quite magical. And I mean, the one thing I have to say is that I am an info hound. And so I cracked the books and I studied all of this stuff like you wouldn't believe. You know, I mean, I'm sure that no PhD candidate has ever studied more. I mean, I now have a 6,000-volume library, you know, and people come in here to look at our online library, you know, which is online with the Schumacher Society in Great Barrington. And they say, have you read any of these books? And I said, look, you can pick up any book in this library and see my markings in the margins of every one of them. I bet there isn't one you can pick up. And that's honestly true, because that's my passion.
And what's interesting is, of course, you never had that passion stunted by actually attending college or graduate school.
Oh, yes, because, you know, the whole thing is that if I had taken Economics 101, I would have suffered brain damage. I might never have recovered.
That's right. You know, you would have known better than to be nearly as audacious as you are.
I didn't know any of this couldn't be done.
That's right.
See? And I think that all of us humans have this incredible potential to teach ourselves through our own curiosity. And we all have this wonderful facility in our brains that, you know, kind of a lens. We have like the zoom lens where you can zoom in and look at all the details. And then we also know how to pull back and take a wide shot and put it all together, you know, and say, yeah, my gosh, I live on a planet. You know, and the planet is powered by photons, free photons from the sun. And we all have that capacity, but when you go through some of this coursework, I think it kind of gets beaten out of you.
As I sort of inferred in the introduction, the big picture aspect, the long term view, the relationships, those sorts of things, I think, are the very things that get lost in so much of academia. Again, let me tell you, this is Free Forum. I'm Terrence McNally. That's Hazel Henderson. An amazing story she's telling of her early years going from mom to activist to expert, all without putting any time in college about that. Her next book is Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. When will that be out, Hazel?
In February, it's going to be launched in the British House of Lords.
Very good. And you can learn more at ethicalmarkets1word.com and hazelhenderson1word.com. So let me ask you one quick question about technology assessment. How long did that panel, which was an official body of the U.S. government that that whose mission, I'm assuming, was to assess technology either before or in the early stages of its implementation for effects other than those strictly on the bottom line. How long did it last? What did you achieve? Why did it end?
Well, the studies, it's very interesting, Terence, but I was looking out some of the early studies that we did in the 1970s and 1980s. We did assessing nuclear power and all of the problems of embrittlement and decommissioning and the costs and all of the things we're now dealing with. It. We did a study of the internal combustion engine and realizing this actually sort of belonged in the Smithsonian and that we needed to move toward electric vehicles or, you know, hydrogen vehicles or whatever, all of those alternatives. We did one on deep water drilling for
oil. Oh, my
God.
And this is in the mid-70s.
Yes. We did one on electronic bulls and bears and what would happen when the stock markets got computerized, which predicted perfectly the mess we're in today with high-frequency trading and the fact that 70% of some, up to 70% of the trades on most exchanges now are untouched by human hands. They're all done by computer algorithms. And so we also looked at the structure of the U.S. economy and the transition that it was going to be going through. And I remember one of the things that set me on the path that I'm on, have been on ever since, was that one of the members of our advisory council, James Fletcher, who went on to become the head of NASA, he told us there, one meeting back in 1975, he said, you know, if we had subsidized solar, wind, energy efficiency, green buildings, and all of that, wind, geothermal, ocean power, as heavily as we have subsidized nukes and coal, oil, and gas, the whole U.S. economy would, by 1975, would have been 100% renewables.
Oh, my
and
God.
That blew me away, and I hit the books. And that was when I left OTA in 1981, I sat down and wrote The Politics of the Solar Age, because I'd seen it all up close. And I'd seen all of these incumbent fossilized sectors and how they were fighting for their subsidies and how they were dissing solar and renewables. And one of the things I did at OTA was to help fund, at least to help, you know, push to get a study funded. We had a budget of about $15 million. To get a study funded of all of these alternative technologies. And we sent the person who we hired to do this study, we sent her around to look at John Todd's Living Machines. We sent her to West Jackson to look at regrowing the prairies. And we sent them to look at organic agriculture and the whole range of alternatives. And so all of those studies that OTA did, they are now in the Library of Congress. There is a set of them at Princeton University and a set of them here at our library. And what we are doing now, we are going to republish the most important of these studies because we now have a publishing deal with a New York publisher, and they're in the public domain.
Oh my gosh! I mean, it seems to me that the title of this, or almost, is Back to the Future, because
What happened was that when the Republicans won back the House in 1996, they immediately shut OTA down.
Office of Technology Assessment.
Yeah, the Office of Technology Assessment. And so we were all, completely zeroed out immediately. And it was like killing the messenger. Except the funny thing was that about 40 other countries had come to Washington and looked at our Office of Technology Assessment and set up ones of their own. And several states had done that too, including the state of Florida, where I ended up moving. So all was not lost. And it's very interesting that the representative from Princeton now, Rush Holt, very good guy.
Mm-hmm.
He is always carrying the torch for, hey, why shouldn't we, you know, we need to have OTA back.
If ever we needed it.
If ever we needed it. But I thought at least what we can do is to republish all of these studies.
Yeah, that sounds excellent.
And yeah, so I'm going to do a little forward to each one saying why it's so important and why back then I supported it being funded and set up.
So when just on these, because I'm sure it's piqued listeners' attention as well, at what point will these begin to be available? And at that point, they can just go to ethicalmarkets.com and find them?
Yeah. Yeah.
At what point do you think? In the spring, late spring?
I hope. This is one of our big projects for next year.
Okay.
And we're going to be working very hard. And luckily, they're all in electronic form.
Yeah.
And so it shouldn't take that long.
No, that sounds just excellent.
Isn't it? But just imagine that, you see. So it is like Back to the Future.
Yeah.
And that's the power of incumbent special interests, you know, whether it's people right now who, you know, because of Citizens United, are able to put all of this money into politics and setting up all of these phony think tanks, you know, that try to diss solar energy and say, oh, it's, you know, only intermittent, it never work, and blah, blah, blah. And so, you know, this is the power that those people have had. But guess what? They have lost the battle. And we are now sure of this, you know, because what I decided when I set up Ethical Markets in 2004, because I realized that mainstream media could never tell the story of the great transition from the fossil fuel era to the solar age, because all of their advertising revenues still came from fossil fuel, fossil sector, which means agriculture, it means big pharma, it means the chemical industry, you know.
Yeah, let me just step back with you on a second for that one, because when you first said that, all of their advertising comes from, someone would say, well, now you're exaggerating. But what you're pointing out is that the fossil fuel dependent industries.
Yes.
The industries that grow out of fossil fuels go way beyond the fossil fuels themselves, as you point out. Agriculture, fertilizers, pharmaceuticals, which I think is one that many people don't know. There's a I found, by the way, the book that did the best job of pointing all of that out was Turning Point by Fritjof Capra in 1981.
Oh, yes, which I worked on.
Okay. But that book, if anyone doesn't know, you may have heard of Fritjof Capra, but if you haven't read that particular book, Turning Point, he analyzes, basically he's writing about we need to shift to a systems understanding of things instead of this sort of dead, separate kind of way, materialist way of looking at things. And he then does this wonderful encyclopedic kind of job of looking at all different sectors of society, and he really makes that point. And when I had him on, probably in the aughts, right, in 2005, let's say, I read the opening to Turning Point, which he wrote in 1981, and it reads, you could read that opening today, and it would sound like it was written today. But for anyone who... Yeah, go ahead. But for anyone who wants to really get a grasp on how all of that's related and that point she was making about how many industries are actually dependent on the fossil fuel industry and are sort of the fossil fuel industry writ large.
This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my 2013 conversation with Hazel Henderson, who as a mom in the 70s got upset about pollution threatening her young child, took action, and became an economist, futurist, author, and creator of the television show and website Ethical Markets.
Okay, so what you've just said is that Technology Assessment did the assessments of many of the industries we're seeing now. It was disbanded, and you, having spent your time in it, came out of it and wrote The Politics of the Solar Age, in which you point out that it is politics and money in politics that is holding us back.
Oh, yeah. And so when I wrote that book, you know, I sort of thought, well, it's time for me to go back around the world because, you know, President Reagan had just come into office and declared he had taken the solar panels off the White House, you know, and all that. And I thought, well, I am, you know, that book of mine was published in, you know, dozens of languages. And I thought, well, you know, hey, I'm going to just follow all these invitations I'm getting to go around the world. And what I wanted to see is the industrial method, which is so destructive of the environment as well as human communities, is it causing the same kind of problems everywhere in the world that we had seen at Citizens for Clean Air in New York and we had seen at OTA? And of course, the answer was yes. And so I was invited to China to give lectures there in 1986. And all during the 1980s, I was flitting around the world. And then when I came back and realized that the mainstream media was not going to be able to tell the story of this great whole system transition that was going on and how exciting it was, and looking at all of the opportunities, you know, whether it's solar panels in China or, you know, green developments in Korea or all of the things I saw. And so I did the first TV series with Ethical Markets, which was broadcast on PBS stations. We got it on to about 50% of all the PBS stations. And we looked at everything, the future of work, you know, how automation was, you know, destroying sector after sector and creating all this disemployment, and which countries were moving toward guaranteed income. It looked like the only way to go. We did the future of healthcare, socially responsible investing. And the funny thing is that those are in worldwide distribution now, Terrence, and we're earning a nice royalty income from those. They are on films.com, and they go to colleges and public libraries all over the world.
Excellent.
And so what we do at Ethical Markets, basically, we are a B corporation. And what we do is our goal is to reform markets and metrics and hasten and accelerate the transition to the cleaner, greener, knowledge-richer economies of the solar age. And that's what we do.
Okay.
So you can see all our TV shows for free on ethicalmarkets.com, our Transforming Finance series. And why do we focus on finance now? Because finance now is the choke point that this global casino, which is totally out of control, is the flywheel of social and environmental destruction all over this planet.
So talk a bit about that. When I've talked about that in the past with economists, with folks who've examined the death or certainly the weakening of the middle class in America, the 1%, 99%, and so on. You're making a slightly different point, I think. You're saying that, and let me just, when you say the financialization in the financial markets, what we know is that we heard for years that the U.S. and probably eventually the world, certainly the developed countries first, we're going to move from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. And I think most of us thought, oh, services, okay. You know, that's legal. It's all sorts of things that deal. But what it really, the biggest jump in there was the shift to the financial industry, that the percentage of our economy that became tied up with finance. And as I think it was Paul Volcker, we finally passed a version of the Volcker rule last week. I think it was Paul Volcker who said that the last worthwhile innovation of the financial industry was the ATM.
I love that.
Yeah, rather than the derivatives, credit default swaps, and so on, which at this point still have untold trillions of dollars tied up in them. And what you're saying is that it is fact that the financial industry has more power, perhaps, than it's ever had, that leads us in the path we're on. Talk a bit about that.
Yes, and it's very difficult for many NGOs to really focus on the fact that finance itself is generating poverty, generating, you know, generating environmental and social destruction, generating unemployment. Because you see, the model is the mirror image of that, as you know, the Washington Consensus, you know, and this sort of free market approach that came in with Reagan and Thatcher, you know, which spread around the world, privatize everything, you know, the magic of the market will take care of everything, which was really why OTA was shut down, because, you know, they said, no, we don't need to assess technology, the magic of the market will do that. Whereas, of course, we know that, like my Chinese friends say, that markets are good servants, but bad masters. And it's the same with finance. Finance properly at home with a really good kind of Glass-Steagall Act, which, of course, got repealed under Clinton. But homegrown finance with local banking, like my friend Ellen Brown promotes in her new book, which I did the foreword to, called The Public Banking Solution. Of course we need finance. I love crowdfunding. You know, we have a page on crowdfunding. So finance is very important, but the more it's local and the more that it's properly regulated, the more it becomes the servant of the real economy. And the moment it escapes out into that global fast lane, then, you know, you're off to the races.
Right. And just you, again, you know. Just to, I will pitch in on this. There are some people who will say, you know, finance bad. And what you're saying is no. Finance and that whole arena, its proper role is to invest in a better future, to allow innovation, to allow someone to build up from their labor to whether it's a home or a small company, whatever it is, finance is necessary to allow the future to bloom.
Yes,
that's when properly regulated and, as you say, absolutely, as local as possible.
As local. And you see, there's credit unions. I mean, it doesn't have to be the old corporate for-profit model. I mean, most people in the U.S. don't know that there are more people in the world employed in cooperatives worldwide than there are in all of the private profit-making corporations put together.
Wow.
People don't understand that. I mean, you know, you can do a very, very robust economy based on cooperatives.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know.
Well, in Spain, which I'm sure you can refer to in greater depth than I can, but the part of the country that is strongest in cooperatives has not suffered the terrible financial dislocation that we hear Spain has fallen to.
Well, you know, here is a great a piece of bad news that I have to really delve into. You know, the Mondragon cooperatives in the Basque region were a beacon for all of us. You know, they had manufacturing. You know, they manufactured refrigerators and machinery, and it was really an absolutely marvelous system. But at this point, that global casino is grabbing more and more of the circuitry, you want to say,
mm-hmm,
really. And at the moment, as I have heard, is some of the units of Mondragon have gone bankrupt.
Oh.
Because if you've got a global economy and people can bring in cheap refrigerators from Vietnam or somewhere, or, you know, Mexico or somewhere, then you're going to put local people out of business, just the way we did with NAFTA.
Yeah, I would guess, and again, this is only from some preliminary reading in this area, not in depth, but that part of it was that it is difficult to be the part of a national economy that's thriving without the rest of the national economy dragging you down.
Yes, particularly when the rest of the national economy is managed so badly.
That's right.
that in Spain, like in Ireland, you know,
that's right.
They were stupid enough to bail out the banks with the taxpayers' money.
That's right.
And so all they did was to crash their own sovereign bonds.
Yes.
And so, you know, the circle was complete.
Hazel, I want to do something here because I made sort of a promise in the intro that we would step way back and look at what the biggest issues were and some of those things. And we've done it in this kind of natural narrative that we've been following. But let me, if I may, step back and ask you some of the questions that I sort of inferred we would. And again, I'm Terrence McNally. This is Freeform. What are, in your mind, the biggest issues? And I guess rather than saying because of the tack you take and the tack I take on the show, rather than saying the ones that are the most destructive, but the ones that are both huge issues and issues about which we have potential solutions.
Well, let's begin with climate change.
Yep, that's the one I have first as well.
Absolutely. And we know that the best way to sequester carbon is to manage agricultural land and grasslands and forests properly. And so I've been working a lot in that area. And there again, you see, if you don't retrain asset managers to understand the real value that there is in managing ecosystems correctly, they're going to keep on, you know, with the destruction. So that's why we created the Principles of Ethical Biomimicry Finance, which follows nature's pattern. And our partners in that are Janine Benyus's biomimicry company. And when you're dealing with how to shift the system, you need to have these asset managers put on new spectacles. And as you know, Bill McKibben has done wonderful work with 360.org. 350.org. And I've been in conversations with him over email. And I've tried to make the point, please don't tell the students to ask these endowments to divest, because it's not the same as South Africa. And if you ask them to, if you're a pension fund manager managing your 401k and you're told to divest, you know, you can't, you'll just buy Walmart or you'll buy, you know, Monsanto or something. So the operative word must be shift. Shift the portfolio. That's why we have the Green Transition Scoreboard.
So you're not saying, let me just be clear, I've had Bill on the show, we've talked about the divestment campaign. You're not saying don't divest, but you're saying don't stop there.
We're saying the word should be shift.
Yeah. In other words, so because while you're divesting in fossil fuel, you are investing in more positive alternatives from a different perspective.
Right. Unless you tell them what you want to shift them to and point them to something like our Green Transition Scoreboard, where we track all the private investments and all of the companies that are investing in green sectors, and our current total is $5.2 trillion with a T since 2007. I mean, the green transition now is totally unstoppable. And the mainstream financial people are terribly worried that they're being, attacked from every direction you can imagine. And they just need to be told, okay, what is it you do want us to invest in? And that's why we update the Green Transition Scoreboard, and we know there's going to be a huge jump when we put the new one out in February. It may be absolutely as we have predicted, that about $1 trillion a year is going into green sectors, and if it goes on at this rate, by 2020, we will have entered the solar age, and the ramping up of solar, wind, and geothermal, and all of these other technologies, particularly energy efficiency and green buildings, will be such that they are cheaper than fossil fuels, and Lord knows, cheaper than the nukes that can't compete economically without, you know, getting their customers to pay ahead of time, which is the, you know, they're still onto that.
And by the way, let me just bring in, because I saw you, one of your recent op-eds, one of your recent columns, referred to let's get rid of externalities and get prices right. For people that don't know, I thought this was the moment. When you're talking about that shift in the economy, when you begin to remove the subsidies from damaging energy sources and energy forms and increase the subsidies to positive energy forms, that's where things can change. And one way that one thing that's going on there is you're making transparent what is currently invisible. Explain
exactly
to people what externalities are and what we need to do about them.
Well, let's forget the stupid term externalities, which is, you know, a hangover from obsolete economics. We don't need economics anymore. We're trying to shift to systems thinking. You know, that's my big... better to go to Hogwarts school, you know, and learn witchcraft than learn economics. It's just hopelessly, hopelessly out of date, too narrow.
But much more damaging.
An externality, all an externality is, and let's just forget that term or start ridiculing it, is just the social and environmental costs of your production, which you're not accounting for. You're quote-unquote externalizing from your balance sheet to push on to taxpayers or future generations, or hide somewhere in the environment. That's all.
Yeah. So in other words, when you produce pollution, and when your pollution produces ill health, those are costs of your product, and yet you ignore them. When you change the culture of a small town by bringing in a big box retailer, that's a cost that never shows up on your books. More simply, when you pay your workers, when you work them only the number of hours and pay them only number of dollars, that means that they need public assistance. That is, that's like externality with a capital E.
Your costs onto taxpayers.
Right.
So that's all externalities are, is a shell game of your accounting. It's improper accounting where you're pushing costs onto taxpayers.
And so when you say that renewables and clean will become better economically than fossil fuels, you weren't even talking about that, were you? You were talking about just the sheer numbers. But when you take into account the numbers that usually don't show up, the numbers in terms of pollution and ill health, et cetera.
Oh, it'll accelerate
exactly.
Enormously.
Exactly.
I mean,
let me ask you then, because we really have just two more minutes.
Okay.
Where can people, besides just going to ethicalmarkets.com, or tell us what they can find there, where can people learn more about... what I really, I always try to link, what are the biggest issues and where are the solutions coming from? So where are the places?
Let's try one more. Let's
okay.
try one more.
Go.
Water, right?
That was, right.
All right, so water is a real biggie. Now, 97% of the water on this planet is salt. It's in oceans. And yet we humans are still fooling around with the 3%. And the way you deal with the water issue, and I'm working very hard on this right now with several groups and business plans, to green deserts. How do you green deserts? With seawater agriculture and salt-loving plants. And there are there's about 300 varieties of salt-loving plants, and you can plant them like all over the Middle East where you have deserts adjacent to salty oceans, and you can make those desert bloom with green plants and algae. The other thing you can do, like my friend Alan Savory does, is restore grasslands. And if you want, we have a lot on that on our website, the Grasslands Project out in North Dakota, South Dakota. And then there are so many other ways of managing lands. So not only do we use more of that 97% of saline water, but we also sequester carbons. This is the proper way to sequester carbons. Now, in terms of our site, everything on our site is free and downloadable, but we in 2014 are also going to have our own MOOC. So we, and everybody knows what a MOOC is, I'm sure. It's like Khan Academy. You know, it's where you bypass the old academic thing, and it means massive online open source courses.
Very good. And, we got to wrap it up, Hazel. This has gone by very, very quickly. So,
and one more thing, crowdfunding.
Crowdfunding, yes.
Okay.
And people, I think, are familiar with that. That's Kickstarter, that's good. Indiegogo,
yeah.
And it's getting larger and larger. The rules in American finance have been changed to actually, which will help crowdfunding. It's a big thing for the future.
Yes.
So the next book is Mapping the Global Transition to the Solar Age. The websites are ethicalmarkets.com and hazelhenderson.com. Thank you, Hazel Henderson. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Terrence. It's been lots of fun, and you keep up the good work.
Very good. Now, for this week's conversations and many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to receive my weekly email announcements, upcoming guests and issues and 3 or 4 articles of background, you can sign up at my site or you can email me at temcnally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to Free Forum podcast on iTunes. Thanks to Federico, my engineer, Stan Mizrahi in production, and to you, my listeners. I look forward to being with you again next week.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show.
Okay, let's get now to the fight to get rid of Robert Mueller. There's a really good article about how Republicans are planning to get rid of Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller in Slate with the goal of ending the Russia investigation. Most of the conversation about getting rid of Mueller is focused around, will Trump fire him or not? Does Trump have the authority to fire him? Does he have to direct someone else like Rod Rosenstein to fire him, which of course could trigger massive protests? Would it stand up constitutionally? But we've now heard from Democratic Congressman Adam Schiff, who says that Republicans are going to go about it the following way. Devin Nunes, Republican congressman, recently said that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, should be held in contempt of Congress. Sounds tough, right? From one Republican to another, one Trump crony to another. Why is Nunes going after Sessions so hard? The reason Devin Nunes says Sessions should be held in contempt is that the Justice Department recently refused to comply with a subpoena from Nunes that includes classified documents. The Justice Department said the documents are classified. It would be very risky for us to comply with the subpoena because if we release that classified information, it could lead to things as serious as people dying. So the idea is, issue subpoenas for classified information, the Department of Justice refuses to comply, and then you slam them for refusing to comply and call for the removal of someone like Rod Rosenstein. Rosenstein has said he's not going to be bullied when it comes to Trump-Russia. You then have the replacement to Rod Rosenstein get in there and say, hey, listen, this thing's too political. We're ending the Mueller investigation. Mueller is fired. The other possibility is you get them to release the classified information through the subpoenas, and then you go after Rosenstein for releasing classified information. So this is the tactic that they're using here. More than likely, Rosenstein would refuse to release that information. Republicans would immediately call for his removal, his replacement, the replacement potentially getting rid of Robert Mueller in a way that is less connected to Trump fired him. It's pretty transparent, right? Like if there's any good thing we can find here is that I would say it's that Devin Nunes' behavior is so obvious and transparent that I would hope it's not going to go unnoticed and actually work. Like Nunes might think he's being really slick all the time and that everything he does is just so well planned, nobody's going to notice. the underlying intentions are abundantly clear, and I'm hoping that prevents this from happening.
And I'm not entirely clear on how Jeff Sessions would be held in contempt of Congress, because didn't he recuse himself from the Russia investigation altogether?
Well, I think some of the requests don't relate to Russia stuff,
okay.
So it could conceivably be within Sessions' purview to either approve or not. But that you're getting at the point here, which is if you specifically make requests related to subject matter on which Sessions is recused, then it goes to Rosenstein,
yes.
And you then make Rosenstein the target. There is one fact that all of this makes undeniably clear, which is that there's only one way to protect Robert Mueller and protect the investigation. You know what it is, Pat? I'm sure you can guess.
Think it over for a little bit.
Vote. November.
Oh, yes.
That's
Vote.
The one
Vote
way.
November.
That's the one
midterms.
Way, right? People voting in the midterm elections and getting Republicans out of power who are part of the protection apparatus of Robert Mueller, the attack apparatus against Robert Mueller is really the only protection that we can give him. And even if we get the left to get out and vote in November, will we have a fair election? Because we know Russia's already trying to tamper with the midterms, and it doesn't seem Donald Trump is too interested in stopping that. So it is a real uphill battle, and at least hopefully awareness of what it is that's being done here will prevent Mueller from being fired in this way. Take a quick break. Discuss this with us on our subreddit at davidpakman.com/reddit. Quick break, back after this.
You've been listening to part of the David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/thedavidpakmanshow.